This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Deadlines: Iran's presidential candidates hold the first of the three televised debates, which focuses on their economic policies. Israeli security forces that is arrest an Al Jazeera reporter in a Palestinian neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds, drawing condemnation from press freedom advocates. And the UN Secretary General has strongly condemned the killing of nearly 140 civilians in Burkina Faso. Welcome to the program. The seven candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential vote have attended a televised debate. It's the first out of three presidential debates which centered on economies. Youssef Jaloli reports.
After days of campaigning for the upcoming presidential vote in Iran, candidates now stand toe-to-toe for a face-off. On Saturday, the seven runners attended the first televised debate, which was aired live on national television. Themed with economy, the first debate required the candidates to answer common questions ranging from monetary policies to domestic production and boosting exports.
In order to boost domestic production, we need to reduce the taxes levied on our producers and in return increase the taxes on unproductive businesses such as real estate or forex trading.
8 years ago, in the same place, I showed you a 10,000 rial banknote and warned you that if the current trend went on, our national currency would collapse. We need to take a different approach than using people's pockets to solve the government's problems.
We have prepared a package that consists of 213 projects. 51 of them are focused on harnessing inflation and controlling the prices.
When we speak about eliminating poverty, we're not just talking about basic rights, but it's also about entertainment and health policies. I have a comprehensive plan that can tackle these issues.
We need to turn our focus toward a 500 million strong market that exists in the region and not our 80 million strong domestic market. I mean, we need to strengthen our regional diplomacy and open up to the world to attract investment.
The debate started with random questions to each of the candidates, but got raucous after Abdel Nasser Hemati picked on the other contenders, saying they're running to promote poverty rather than wealth.
Unlike the other candidates, I don't like to resort to lying to attract more votes. None of them is speaking of the distribution of wealth, but increasing poverty. I will pay equal attention to both creating wealth and its fair distribution.
Hemati's comment was not left unanswered, as Alireza Zakani lashed out at him by reminding him of his poor performance as the head of the Central Bank of Iran, blaming him for the unprecedented devaluation of the national currency, the rial, which is currently traded at 240,000 against the U.S. dollar.
You have dealt an irreparable blow to the national currency, yet you accuse us of spreading poverty. You have already increased poverty during your tenure, while I speak of national production and boosting it. So please stop making accusations.
There are still two debates to go. The second and third debates will take place on Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will investigate the candidates' cultural and political policies.
Well, the debate offers an opportunity for each of the candidates to try to stand out and make the best impression to voters. It also gives a chance to the public to weigh up all the choices in one go. Yet, it's still too soon to judge about who stands a better chance to win the race, since the rivalry is still on. Youssef Jaloli, Tehran.
Welcome to this hour's On the Newsline. Iran has condemned a UN decision to temporarily revoke Tehran's voting rights in the General Assembly over its outstanding contributions to the world body. Tehran argues it's paid its dues to the world body regularly, and it's the economic sanctions that have made payments increasingly difficult for the country.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states. He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions.
The UN says Iran needs to pay over $16.2 million to have its voting rights restored. This is while, under Article 19 of the UN Charter, the General Assembly has the authority to determine whether the failure to pay the dues has been beyond the country's control, in which case it can allow the country to continue to vote. Considering that the sanctions against Iran have been one of the most severe against any nation, why hasn't the world body given Iran a waiver on its voting rights?
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the US blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned. No stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impact of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
A military base belonging to the U.S.-led coalition has come under a rocket attack in the high-security green zone of the Iraqi capital of Baghdad. A spokesman for the coalition said a rocket landed near the Baghdad Diplomatic Support Center without causing any injuries or damage. The source of the rocket was not immediately known. Washington's military and diplomatic buildings have been increasingly targeted in recent months in Iraq amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. In Jordan, several security forces are injured following the Interior Ministry called an armed attack near the capital. Following what the Interior Ministry actually called an armed attack near the capital, Amman, the ministry said the security personnel were injured near Queen Alia International Airport, some 30 kilometers south of Amman. It said the forces were dealing with riots, burning vehicles, and shootings by a group of people in the Naur district. No further information has been provided by Jordanian officials. Now, Israeli forces have attacked a sit-in protest in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem al-Quds. Israeli police arrested a correspondent covering the gathering for the Al Jazeera news network and damaged her crew's equipment. The move sparked condemnation from press freedom advocates. The rally was held to mark the 54th anniversary of the Naksa Day, or Day of Setback. The day is commemorated on July the 5th every year to mark the displacement of Palestinian people from the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, following the Six-Day War in 1967. And now as many as 1,000 pro-Palestine protesters have created a human wall to block an Israeli cargo ship from unloading at the port of Oakland in the U.S. The Israeli ship that docked on a Friday morning remained fully loaded with cranes idle as longshore workers refused to cross the protesters' picket lines. Demonstrators carried signs and waved Palestinian flags outside the port, blocking truck traffic from four marine terminals. The move was part of a week-long international Block the Boat campaign, in which activists are mobilizing to prevent Israeli ships from docking at ports around the world. The campaign is in response to Israel's recent assault on Gaza, which killed at least 248 people, including at least 67 children. Activist and commentator Nick Ayala says movements like the Block the Boat campaign help raise awareness of the Palestinians' plight around the world.
I think this campaign is important in specifically radicalizing and raising the consciousness of the workers in a lot of these ports, because again, at least here in the United States, the situation is a bit unique in that a lot of these protests and these pickets are occurring not in the unions themselves. Sometimes they take part and they show solidarity, but the leadership and the organizing is coming from Palestinian communities and Palestinian organizations, Arab organizations, who go to these ports to strike or to protest these freighters. We saw, I think it was only just a few weeks ago, where similar things were happening in South Africa again, where they were blocking Israeli ships. And in Italy, we saw unions coming together to essentially stop Israeli ships or stop the freighters from being loaded and then sent to Israel. Here in the United States, it's interesting in that, again, as I mentioned, it's the Palestinian organizations that are taking that leadership role, But that's important because what it does do is, like I said, it raises the consciousness of the workers at these ports, making them realize that, you know, there is a connection between what is happening in Gaza, what is happening in Palestine, and the commerce or the freighter or just the regular everyday work that we tend to take for granted here in the United States.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the massacre of civilians in Burkina Faso's volatile north. Guterres's spokesman said the United Nations underscores the urgent need for the international community to redouble support for the fight against violent extremism. Stefan Dujarric also said that the UN fully supports the authorities in their efforts to overcome the threats to peace, stability, and unity in their country. Well, this comes after militants killed at least 138 civilians in two Burkinabe villages in the deadliest attack since 2015. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the carnage, but Al-Qaeda-linked groups are known to be operating in the region. Burkina Faso, along with neighboring Mali and Niger, have come under frequent terrorist attacks in the past year. At least three people have been killed in northern Iraq during a Turkish airstrike on a camp housing Kurdish refugees. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had earlier warned Iraq that Ankara would clean up the refugee camp, which it says provides a haven for Kurdish militants. Turkey has ramped up attacks on bases of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, in northern Iraq over the past year. The operation mainly focuses on a strip of territory several kilometers inside the Iraqi border. In a separate incident, five Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga fighters were killed and four wounded in a PKK ambush in the town of Amedi in the northern Kurdistan region. Hundreds of people in small rowing boats have protested in Italy's Venice as the first cruise ship since the easing of coronavirus restrictions set out to leave the city's ports. The protesters surrounded and followed the 92,000-ton MSC Orchestra as it departed Venice port, heading for Croatia and Greece. The Italian government ruled in April that cruise ships and container vessels must not enter the city's historic center, but the ban will not take effect until terminals outside the lagoon have been completed. Campaigners worry about safety and the environment of Venice, including pollution and underwater erosion in a city already in peril from rising sea levels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The COVID-19 crisis has exacerbated pre-existing inequalities and undermined progress on poverty reduction, gender equality, and battling child and forced labor, according to the International Labor Organization. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, UN Labor Agency Finds Pandemic Pushed Over 100 Million Workers into Poverty. Stay tuned for more. Over a year after projecting that the coronavirus pandemic could have a catastrophic impact on the global economy and workforce, the United Nations Labor Agency recently revealed that the public health crisis pushed more than 100 million workers worldwide into poverty. The new report entitled World Employment and Social Outlook Trends 2021, WESO Trends, also warns of the real risk that absent comprehensive and concerted policy efforts, the COVID-19 crisis will leave behind a legacy of widened inequality and reduced overall progress in the world of work across multiple dimensions. Worryingly, the International Labor Organization, ILO, report shows that the recovery process is likely to be both incomplete and uneven, said Guy Ryder, the agency's director general, in a video about the findings. Incomplete because the damage done will not be fully repaired by the end of 2022. We will still have a major jobs shortfall, Ryder explained. Uneven because it's the rich countries, the high-income countries, which are the best placed, because they have vaccines, because they have the fiscal means to do so to recover more quickly. So the danger is a bit of a two-speed recovery, he continued, noting that not only workers in poor countries, but also those in vulnerable sectors globally could be left behind. He added, we need a different option. We need a human-centered recovery, which will prevent that from happening. The ILO found, relative to 2019, an additional 108 million workers worldwide are now moderately or extremely poor, meaning their families must survive on less than $3.20 per person each day. The report says that 5 years of progress towards the eradication of working poverty have been undone. The pandemic has highlighted the vulnerable situation of migrant workers and undermined recent progress on gender equality, the report adds. According to Agence France-Presse, Ryder told reporters that the ongoing crisis has also negatively affected efforts to end child and forced labor. Looking ahead, the projected employment growth will be insufficient to close the gaps opened up by the crisis, WESO Trends warns. To make matters worse, many of the newly created jobs are expected to be of low productivity and poor quality. The UN agency projects that the pandemic-induced jobs gap will hit 75 million this year and fall to 23 million next year. The gap in working hours, which accounts for the jobs gap and hours reductions, is expected to be the equivalent of 100 million full-time jobs in 2021 and 26 million full-time jobs in 2022. As the overall economic situation starts to improve and pandemic-related restrictions are lifted, large numbers of people who were previously inactive in the labor market will enter the labor force again, the report says. Adding, however, owing to the lack of sufficient jobs, the global unemployment headcount will remain elevated throughout 2021 and 2022 at 220 million and 205 million unemployed, respectively. While the most affected regions in the first half of this year have been Latin America and the Caribbean, as well as Europe and Central Asia, ILO points out that the pandemic further exposed racial and ethnic inequality in North America. In the United States specifically, the crisis illuminated inequalities in health and economic outcomes linked to entrenched structural barriers. Worldwide, employment in the accommodation and food services sector is estimated to have been the worst affected by the crisis, says the report. The wholesale and retail trade sector was also heavily hit, as was manufacturing and construction, which incurred a significant decline in employment as a result of the crisis, bearing the brunt of the impact in the industry sector. Recovery from COVID-19 is not just a health crisis. The serious damage to economies and societies needs to be overcome too, Ryder emphasized in a statement. Ryder added, without a deliberate effort to accelerate the creation of decent jobs and support the most vulnerable members of society and the recovery of the hardest hit economic sectors, the lingering effects of the pandemic could be with us for years in the form of lost human and economic potential and higher poverty and inequality. We need a comprehensive and coordinated strategy based on human-centered policies and backed by action and funding. There can be no real recovery without a recovery of decent jobs.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
So we've just gone through a tremendous moment in history, actually, in recent history, as well as human history, and I feel like it's leading up to something big. Of course, I'm talking about Palestine, the 12-day war. We've taken to calling it the 12-day war now. The question that I would like to ask and get your point of view on is, why did this war take place? And what is the significance of Masjid al-Aqsa? I think I'll go to Sheikh Ali first.
Okay. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, a very important phase of history that we are living in. It's kind of interesting how we're living history and we're making history. If you look at why the war broke out, I would want to say that the war always existed. The war was ongoing. It's just the scale of the war and the attention that the world got in terms of, the conflict and in terms of the nonstop, constant oppression on the oppressed Palestinians for over 70 years, that just got a bit more attention from the public. That's what changed. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the exchange of rockets and missiles, that was something significant, which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But the conflict, the war, the battle It existed for the last 70 years. Alhamdulillah, the resistance faction never gave up on what is their right to exist, their right to live, their right to own their own property, and their right to enjoy the resources and utilize the resources what were there originally, till the illegal settlers called the Zionists, they moved in and started to steal from the Palestinians. So it has been going on. Masjid al-Aqsa, as you know, it is a holy place, for not only for Muslims, but for Christians, for Jewish people. And throughout the history, this place has been this focal point of worship and submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by all these Abrahamic religions, right? The issue is that some, they try to have exclusive right over Masjid al-Aqsa. This is where the problem begins.
Mm-hmm.
See, every time in the history when Muslims came into power and they had the control of this region or this area, they never prohibited Christians and Jewish people from coming and worshiping, right? Doing their rituals, whatever they may be, right? But whenever the Zionists and, you know, the Jewish people came there, like, oh, that's exclusively ours. You have no right. And even if you have to come, you have to seek permission and, get permission from us.
Wow.
So this is where the issue is. Masjid al-Aqsa is, as you know, is the first Qibla of Muslims before Kaaba was declared to be the Qibla. So it definitely is a very sensitive masjid for Muslims as well as for other denominations.
Sayyid Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think very eloquently and clearly Sheikh Ali talked about how this is not a war which just happened to happen in these 12 days. This is an ongoing war. This is an ongoing, in two ways. It's one is an ongoing aggression on behalf of the Zionists and those that are supporting the Zionists for well over 70 years. And on the other hand, it is a defense by the Palestinians, the native Palestinians, whether they are Christians, Muslims, or Jews, against this attack and onslaught by the Zionist forces. I think what happens is sometimes when we use the term war, it sounds like both sides are aggressors, when in fact in this Palestinian case, the Palestinians are not the aggressors. In fact, they are the oppressed who have been bulldozed by the Zionist regime and those supporting the Zionist regime, namely the United States and Britain, who have been for over 70 years attacking and pillaging and looting and destroying lands and killing women and children. So these guys are the ones at war, and the Palestinians are the ones that are on the defense. So in this recent, I just said we shouldn't use the word war.
But it was a war. Right?
But yeah, in this recent war, right, we find that the Zionist regime in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah was expelling Palestinian natives, you know, so these were people who had their houses in Sheikh Jarrah, which is a neighborhood in East Al-Quds. In the Western media, it's known as East Jerusalem. So it's in East Al-Quds. And so what happened is these Palestinians who had their homes there, they were being expelled. They were being thrown out by the Zionist regime for no reason, you know, other than they're Palestinians and maybe they're Arabs and maybe they're Muslims. So they were being kicked out of this neighborhood. So the Sheikh Jarrah guys, these people, they stood up and they started to protest. We're not going to leave our homes. We have had our homes for, you know, centuries, and we've been living here in this city. Now, what's interesting is this taking these Palestinians out of this neighborhood is in order to Zionize Jerusalem, to Zionize Al-Quds. Unfortunately, in the media, it's called the Judaization of Jerusalem. And it's not the Judaization, right? They're not making anybody Jews. They're not making into a, you know, Jewish enclave. This is another one of the things that the Zionists do, is they try to confuse Zionism with Judaism. So it's not the Judaization of Jerusalem. It is the Zionization of Al-Quds. So the guys in Sheikh Jarrah, they got up, they started to protest. Then the guys in Gaza, and these are all resistance forces now, the guys in Gaza, they stood up in defense of the Sheikh Jarrah people. And so when the resistance forces in Gaza stood up, then the Zionist regime stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which the significance was talked about by Sheikh Ali. The Zionist regime storms the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the holy month of Ramadan when people are fasting, you know, when people are praying, when people are engaged in worship. They storm the mosque not once but multiple times. So then the resistance forces in Gaza, they say, listen, if you continue to violate the sanctities of not just the Muslims but Christians and Jews, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, we're going to retaliate and you're not going to like it. Zionist regime continues to bring in their boots and their army and their weapons and their guns into a holy sanctuary, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so then the resistance forces in Gaza, they say, listen, we're going to start firing rockets if you don't stop. And we give you a certain amount of time, right? The Zionist regime didn't care. They laughed it off. You know, these guys are just bluffing. They continued to attack these people, protesters.
Civilian areas, yeah.
And so then the rockets started. The resistance forces, they started to use rockets, which again is something unprecedented, which we'll talk about later. And after this,
I mean, they've used rockets before, but it's just this time the volume of the rocket was so great.
Yeah, and so we'll get into it a little bit later. But then finally, so then the Zionists, in response to these rockets from the resistance forces, they start to bombard the Gaza Strip with fighter jets and bombs and destroying a few stories buildings and really taking things out of control. The Zionist regime acting very shamelessly, very wildly, very savagely, which my last point definitely shows that this is a incredibly, incredibly dangerous regime, not just for the region, but for the world at large.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Okay, so I've got your points of view, but now I'd like to get your opinions. Sheikh Ali, like, how did the war make you feel? And from the beginning to the end, how did it make you feel?
This particular war?
Yeah, the 12-day war.
Well, I think, I don't know how the listeners are going to take it, but I think it is an opportunity. It is an opportunity that the oppressed Palestinians had. See, one thing we have to realize is that no matter what the Palestinians do or don't do, they're subjected to constant pressure, oppression, and, you know, deprivation, and, you know, kicking them out. Their houses are being bulldozed, right? No matter what they do or they don't do, whether they fight or they don't fight, right? It is being done. So, in a way, and of course, war overall is never good, right? Nobody likes to have war, and we're not proposing that war is good. But in this case of Palestinians, I think it's an opportunity that they had an opportunity to express themselves, to let the world know. The world saw it, and you saw how the people, the free people of the world, protested in support of Palestinians and against Zionists, right? So in this way, if you go from this look at it from this lens, it was an opportunity. It was a beautiful thing that happened. They got to express themselves. Alhamdulillah, you know, one thing that we haven't mentioned so far on this show is that the Zionist regime was defeated.
Yeah.
And this is a public knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Now, when have you last heard of the oppressed being on the winning side.
It's great feeling, you know? Isn't it? Yeah.
This in itself is a good news and a glad tiding for all those who are oppressed out there, all those who are sick and tired of American hegemony, all those who are subjected to Zionism and their oppression and constant crimes, their target killings, their covert operations in the region, and so on and so forth.
This is the fact that they could not defeat the Ghazan resistance.
And we have to talk about it, definitely. You know, this is, you know, the Gaza, right? Gaza is like, it's a very small strip, right, of people. And all they could attack and incur damage on was their infrastructure and their civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis couldn't even defeat the Gaza's resistance faction, let alone West Bank, let alone the rest of the Palestine, let alone Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Mm.
And when we talk about, you know, the IRGC, they can't even dream of that, right?
Yeah.
So they, the resistance faction, the resistance in Iraq, and Najib al-Qatar, Hezbollah, right? It's a nightmare.
Right.
Look at Yemen, right? Do you think Yemen, and like Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, he said, you know, we're ready, we are on a standby. He said it before this war, too.
Yeah.
We're there to help our Palestinian brothers, right? So that ummah is being formed.
I think Sayyid Mehdi mentioned this before, that Yemen actually offered a truce, a temporary ceasefire with the Saudis so that they could go and join the battle against Israel.
You know what they said, and this is beautiful again, you know, this is not only politically beautiful, it's a very important Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi al Munkar, right? Bidding the good and forbidding the evil that the Yemenis did.
Mm.
Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi comes out and in his speech, he says, Saudis, listen, we know we've been at war. We know that you have been crushing us. You have been, you know, pushing us against the wall. And now for last one or so year, 1.5 years or so, we have been retaliating. Yes, we are at war, and now we are incurring damage to you. But at the end of the day, you call yourself Muslims. We call ourselves Muslims, right? At the end of the day, we know that there are Zionists who are attacking Palestine and our Palestinian brothers, sisters, elderly, women, children. So let's join forces, do a truce on this war. We can take it up at another time, right, at a later stage. Let's go help our Muslim brothers.
Excellent.
It was such a great move, right? Not just ideologically, not just religiously, even politically it makes sense, right? This is what he did. And see, Saudis would never pick up any arms against the mushrikeen, the kuffar, the Zionists, the oppressors, the aggressors. No, they're actually on their side. So this exposed their filthy face, the filthy face of the Saudi regime.
Okay,
right?
So I'm getting that you felt a mixture of pride and...
Yes, I think Alhamdulillah is good. I think the oppressed should get their right at any cost, and the world should be on their side in getting that right.
That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the show, from myself and from our dear guests. We bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was spot on when he said at the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting on 24th of February, the pandemic has exacerbated old problems such as racism and xenophobia, as well as discrimination against national and religious minorities. Mass protests in the United States and Europe have exposed these countries' continuing systemic inequalities, whilst highlighting the risk of condoning extremist ideologies. We've prepared for you an article written by former Indian diplomat M.K. Badrakumar under the heading, U.S. Exceptionalism Surges Again, Will It Fly? The article has been taken from the AsiaTimes.com website. In recent statement marking the return of the United States to the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, claimed that President Joe Biden's administration is placing democracy and human rights at the center of American foreign policy. But the cat is out of the bag. The U.S. is in relative decline, and there is a resource crunch. There is an absence of a positive vision for humanity as the country struggles with its own demons. The dramatic events in American society and politics in recent past badly exposed the country as a sham democracy with an abominable record of racism and appalling inequality, where the top 0.1% of the population hold roughly the same share of the country's wealth as the bottom 90% of the population. But the resurrection of American exceptionalism will have no takers, and the United States, lacking the capacity and the moral authority to advance a unifying agenda in the international arena, is assembling a toolkit for its diplomacy with geopolitical objectives. The potential of the United Nations Human Rights Council ought to be directed at the raging COVID-19 pandemic, which has undermined the social and economic foundations of states. The most fundamental human right, the right to life, has been threatened, with the world economic downturn causing a big rise in unemployment and aggravating social insecurity. The development gaps between nations and regions are widening. Yet the United States is in a category of itself, even among the so-called rich countries of the world. COVID-19 deaths per million inhabitants have gone through the roof in the United States in comparison with its own allies. The appalling reality is that in the United States, the death toll from the epidemic has now gone over 500,000. Ironically, per capita COVID-19 deaths in some of the countries that Anthony Blinken berates for deficit in democracy and human rights put the U.S. to shame, including in Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and Sri Lanka, and of course, China. But for the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, such a horrific level of deaths among his countrymen isn't a human rights issue. Not a single state functionary in the United States has been held responsible for such a tragedy of unspeakable proportions. Suffice it to say, the U.S. is bringing disrepute and shame to the whole Western world by leading them into such a cynical game. Strutting around as champions of human rights when, according to a recent estimate, more than half of all vaccines against COVID-19 have been reserved for 1/7 of the world's population. Isn't that a matter of human rights? The United Kingdom alone has reportedly secured enough vaccines to give each of its citizens 5 doses. If orders are met, the European Union and the United States could inoculate their populations 3 times over, whilst Canada would have enough to do so 9 times over. It is a disaster, Mr. Blinken. At the same time, competition for diminishing vaccine supplies may lead to price hikes and further friction. Acrimony has erupted among the European Union, the United Kingdom, and AstraZeneca over a shortfall in vaccine production. Meanwhile, in any situation where supplies are scarce and demand is rising, it is the poorer countries that will suffer most. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was spot on when he said at the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting on 24th of February, "The pandemic has exacerbated old problems such as racism and xenophobia, as well as discrimination against national and religious minorities. Mass protests in the United States and in Europe have exposed these countries' continuing systemic inequalities, whilst highlighting the risks of condoning extremist ideologies. It is utter moral bankruptcy that the United States and its rich allies in the Western world walk into the United Nations Human Rights Council and start pontificating about human rights and pursue coercive approaches and unlawful methods of intimidation and pressure with narrow and self-serving geopolitical goals. Again, aren't the non-transparent policies of social networking platforms a matter of human rights too? The US, in particular, undertook commitments to ensure freedom of access to information for all citizens, but is now hiding behind corporate policies to avoid delivering on these commitments. As for the social networking platforms, they have begun brazenly to manipulate public opinion in the developing countries by banning or censoring user content at their own discretion. Now they are, under United States protection, trampling on the human rights of world citizens, aren't they? The Human Rights Toolkit is universally applicable, and there are many countries on Earth, including the United States of America, that have a problem with democracy and human rights. Isn't it a crying shame that an average black American lives 6 years less than his white countrymen? Don't black Americans get locked up in jails in much larger numbers than whites? But the United States' human rights standards are highly selective. It's the white man's burden. Evidently, the toolkit becomes a potent weapon to stigmatize the United States' rivals, Russia and China, and to pressure small countries that do not conform to America's wrong policies, countries like Sri Lanka, Cuba, and Venezuela. The toolkit has been used to bring about regime change too, that is, overthrow established governments and replace them with client regimes. The best-known examples are Ukraine and Georgia. A recent attempt has been made in Belarus, but that flopped. A trial project in Russia in recent weeks was simply squashed by the Kremlin. but it is a developing story. The countries in the periphery of Russia are being systematically destabilized and turned into theaters of geopolitical contestation so that the United States' great rival will get entrapped in a quagmire. The Biden administration is using this toolkit to try to establish the United States' so-called transatlantic leadership, which Europe is no longer comfortable with. Europe is experiencing the hidden charms of strategic autonomy. But the US cannot hope to exercise global hegemony without the Western alliance system backing it either. In the shadow play, Joe Biden estimates that the human rights plank stands the best chance of bringing the United States' Western allies on board under its leadership. Indeed, the Western concept of human rights, narrowly focused on freedom of speech and freedom of religion and democratic elections, tends to overlook that the basic right of the bulk of humanity is about the right to life and the right to development. The Western countries refuse to accept the fact that there are many roads to development and prosperity for the developing countries, and their path is only one of them, and perhaps not even the best or the most suitable path. Plainly put, human rights are being used as a tool to reinforce and perpetuate the present global order in accordance with Western interests. However, it is a losing battle. A new world order is taking shape with a vastly different global humanitarian agenda, which will inevitably become the mainstream for human society. According to a plan jointly issued recently by the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China and the State Council on China's Comprehensive Transportation Network layout, the country aims to build all over the world 200,000 kilometers of railways, 460,000 kilometers of highways, and 25,000 kilometers of high-level sea lanes, with 27 major coastal ports, 400 civil transportation airports, and 80 express hubs by 2035. Which will make the country not only a global production center, but a logistics center, trade center, clearing center, and financial center, laying a solid foundation for a path to be the world's economic center, as an expert put it. How could the Biden administration possibly counter this latest Chinese challenge? Unsurprisingly, the United States is at its wit's end in dealing with China's surge. In 2020, China's gross domestic product was more than 70% the size of the United States. The current forecast is that it will surpass the United States to be the world's largest economy by 2028. The US realizes that the economic race is pretty much already lost.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.